All right, let's open our Bibles to Genesis 36. Our text is Genesis 36, verse 1, all the way to chapter 37, verse 1. Now, I'm not going to read the whole genealogy because I don't think we need to understand what's there. I'd encourage you to read it. But what we're going to do is walk through it and talk about some of the significant things that are happening and what they're telling us about the covenant. I do want to read the first 8 verses of chapter 36, and then we're going to skip down to chapter 37, verse 1, and I want to read that too, just to give us bookends, and then we'll work through it together. So Genesis 36, verse 1, let's listen carefully. This is God's word. These are the generations of Esau, that is Edom. Esau took his wives from the Canaanites, Adah, the daughter of Elon, the Hittites, Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon, the Hivite, and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Nebaioth. And Adah bore to Esau Eliphaz, Basemath bore Reuel, and Oholibamah bore Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, his livestock, all his beasts, and all his property that he had acquired in the land of Canaan. He went into a land away from his brother Jacob, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojournings could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau settled in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. And then skip down to chapter 37, verse 1. Notice the contrast between verse 8 of 36 and verse 1 of 37. Esau settled in the hill country of Seir, but Jacob, we're told in verse 1 of the next chapter, Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. Thus ends the reading of God's word. I was tempted to skip Genesis 36. We've done a couple of genealogies, and they're not the easiest to preach through. They're pretty easy to sit down and, well, they're maybe not even easy to do that. It's easier to sit down and talk through them in a Bible study. It's really hard to preach them. But I think it's important that we do it. I was tempted too because Joseph is fun, and we're moving to Joseph next time, and there's some great stories, obviously, really familiar, beautiful pictures of Christ. It's going to be really nice to be in Joseph in December and think about how he prefigures Jesus Christ. But we needed to stop here. And one of the reasons is because if we remember the structure of Genesis, this is clearly an important chapter. Remember, besides the book of beginnings, this is also the book of generations. I think if I remember correctly, there are 10 different generations that are mentioned in Genesis, and the books are divided that way. So we have the beginning and end of a generation, and then we have the beginning and end of the next. And chapter 36 is the generation of Esau. It's it. It's only this genealogy. And it ends, by the way, in 37 verse 1. This is one of those places where the chapter division is really unhelpful. Because if you look, chapter 37 verse 2, it says these are the generations of Jacob. So the generations of Esau actually ended in verse 1. So that's why I wanted to add that to there. And I think that by looking at chapter 37, verse 1 with chapter 36, it actually explains why it's important to have the generations of Esau included in Genesis. Did you notice the contrast between verse 8 of chapter 36 and verse 1 of chapter 37? Esau settled in the hill country of Seir. Now, why is that significant? Where is Seir or where isn't Seir? Not in the promised land. Esau leaves the promised land. He could have, by the way, gone north of where Jacob was and found more land in the promised land. The sense I think that we're supposed to get is that the land in Seir was better, and so he chose greener pastures over the promised land. That tells us something about Esau, right? He's never had a vision for the covenant. He's never really cared about the promises. He just wants stuff. And so Esau leaves the promised land. Jacob, on the other hand, stays. And notice how it describes the promised land. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings. Remember, a sojourner is a pilgrim who doesn't have property. So Abraham lived in the promised land and never had a place to call home. Isaac lived in the promised land and never had a place to call a permanent home. Jacob is now going to live in the promised land for a while and have no place to call home before he's forced to leave and go to Egypt. So this is the contrast that I think we're supposed to see. And I think that's the whole point, is the contrast here between Esau and Jacob. The contrast between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. That's what we're supposed to see. We've seen it before, right? The generations of Adam, we had two genealogies. The genealogy of Cain, seed of the serpent. The genealogy of Seth, the seed of the woman. We saw it as well at the end of Abraham. We were given seven short verses that were the generations of Ishmael, seed of the serpent. And we were given many chapters of the generations of Isaac, seed of the woman. And now we have the generations of Esau, seed of the serpent. And we're going to have, beginning in chapters 37 to the end of Genesis, the generations of Jacob, the seed of the woman. And we're going to see, especially as it regards Jacob and Esau, that this confrontation between the serpent and the woman, as it's manifest in Esau and Jacob, is a confrontation that goes on for 800 years before it's finally settled with the seed of the woman. And I think that's where this whole text is driving us, to when that conflict will eventually be settled. Now, as we look at this book, there's some parallels to the generations of Ishmael. Book 7, if we count them out for the 10 generations, Book 7, which is chapter 25, verses 12 through 18, that was the generations of Ishmael, 7 verses long. And now Book 9, one chapter, are the generations of Esau. Now, one parallel is they're the two shortest generations in the book of Genesis, which I think is important because for all intents and purposes, for the history of redemption, they're insignificant beyond this point because they don't carry the promise. And yet they're still here. I want to ask that question. Why do you think they're still here? Why do we need to hear about Ishmael and about Esau? What do you think? I'm going to do a little more interaction today because I know we ate and we're full and we're tired. So I'm going to ask questions. Why do we need to have Ishmael and Esau? Okay. It's a contrast. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. We're going to see the Amalekites. We're going to talk about them today. What else do you think? They're still children of Abraham, right? So they're significant simply by the fact that their father is a patriarch. Ishmael's father, Abraham, Esau's father, Isaac, are patriarchs. And so they still have some significance. In fact, we're going to see that as wicked as the Edomites are to Israel, they're supposed to treat them like brothers and love them, even though your natural tendency would be to destroy them. In fact, that's what's going to distinguish the Edomites from the Amalekites. Amalek is a child of Esau, a grandchild of Esau. And yet they're told to completely destroy Amalek, but they're told not to destroy Edom. And I think that's significant. And that's one of the reasons that Esau's here. He's still a child of Isaac, and that makes him significant. Now, the verses that we read, verses 1 through 8, we see a couple things about Esau in these verses that I think tell us everything that we need to know about this man. First of all, do you notice his wives? Jacob was sent away to find wives from Abraham's family. Esau, if you remember, he almost does it intentionally. We've already been introduced to some of his wives. It seems like at the point that they send Jacob away to find wives that are within the covenant family, that Esau intentionally, as if to thumb his nose at his mother, goes and marries Canaanites. And so he has three wives, two Canaanites, and one Ishmaelite, all of them outside of the covenant. So we learn about Esau right away simply in where he finds his wives. But we notice as well, as I already mentioned, just the place where Esau decides to settle tells us something about this man. There are some parallels, if you remember, from what happened with Abram and Lot, right? Abram and Lot are living in the same land and they both become so wealthy and prosperous that there's not enough grass, basically, for their flocks to feed. And so they need to go somewhere else. And Lot shows his character by the way that he chooses where to live. Abraham tells him, you get to pick first, even though I'm the one through whom the promise of God comes. I'll let you pick first. And what Lot should have said, of course, was, no, Abram, you're the man of promise. You should pick and I'll go where you tell me. But instead, remember that Lot looks out and he sees what? Green land. And he sees over here desert. And he says, Abraham can have the desert. I'm taking the good stuff. And we see Lot's character. And then, of course, as he chooses that land, he sets up his tent outside of Sodom. And then he sets it next to Sodom. And pretty soon he has a house in Sodom. And he becomes part of this wicked people. Whereas Abraham is told to look out and he sees everything. And God tells him it all belongs to him. And the reason is because, or the way that we can see the character of Abram as a child of promise is because he sees with eyes of faith. Now, what do we see with Esau? Does he see with eyes of faith? No. He knows. I mean, Jacob is going to get the best land, right? Because the blessing and the birthright from Isaac is going to Jacob. And so he gets first choice. But Esau doesn't have to leave the promised land. He could have gone again north of where Jacob was. And there was plenty of prosperous land in the middle of the promised land. But instead he goes to Seir. And in fact, he goes to Seir. And if you look through the genealogy and read it, especially as you get to verses 20 through 30, it seems as if he conquers the pagan lands and then he brings them and makes them his own. And so he and his sons and his grandsons begin marrying pagans. And they make that their home. And Jacob instead sees with eyes of faith, just like Abraham. It's interesting, isn't it, that the patriarchs depend on the promises of God and their eyes are fixed on those things, even if they don't have them yet. And so Jacob can say, it's better for me to remain in the promised land and live in tents and wander and sojourn the rest of my life than to go to Seir and to find a rich and prosperous place and build big cities, but be outside of the covenant. Jacob sees with eyes of faith. But there's not just a geographical division that's going on here. There's a spiritual division, right? And we see it work out in the history of these two nations. Remember Genesis 3:15. This promise right after Adam and Eve fall in sin is that God will raise up a seed of the woman. The seed of the serpent will bruise his heel and he will crush the head of the serpent. There's animosity between these two seeds. And we see that working out already in the life of Esau and Jacob. We've seen it working out since chapter 25. There's conflict that's going on. Now, there are certain things that I want us to learn about this conflict or to think about. One of the things that the scriptures make really clear is that when we look at Jacob and Esau, we should be learning something about election, right? Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. But right before that in Romans 9, he says that I chose them before there was anything good or bad in them. Why did God choose Esau and not Jacob? We don't know. Because he did. Because he set his love on Jacob. It wasn't certainly because Jacob was admirable. He becomes admirable as God molds him. But it wasn't because Jacob displayed some kind of admirable qualities that caused God to choose him because he was better than Esau. It's simply because God chose him. But then we see God's election working out in their lives, right? Jacob has a heart for the covenant. Even when he's lying and deceitful, he has a heart for the covenant. He knows that he wants the things that God's promised to Abraham and Isaac. And Esau's willing to sell them because he's hungry. And now he's willing to sell them because he wants pastures. Now, I want us to do a brief sketch or outline of the conflict between Edom and Israel, because I think that's where this text is driving us. We'll do a little Bible quizzing here. What's the next time after this that we run into the Edomites? Or the Israelites run into the Edomites? Anybody have an idea? Numbers. Numbers chapter 20. What's happening then? Right. Israel's coming back to the promised land. And the easiest, most direct route is through Edom. Moses goes to the king of the Edomites and asks him, can we pass through your land? We won't touch anything. We won't take anything. And they say, absolutely not. They won't give them bread, they won't give them water, and they won't let them walk through their land. And so the Israelites, after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, have to go a different route all the way around Edom to the east, up above it, and back around again so they can get to the promised land. And why will Edom not allow the Israelites? Because of the animosity between Jacob and Esau. We see it again in 1 Samuel 14, verse 47. Saul is fighting against the Edomites. But as Saul tends to do, he doesn't finish the battle. And so David has to come back again. And we're told in at the end of 1 Samuel that in 2 Samuel 8 verses 13 and 14, that David actually conquers Edom and they set up garrisons. They take control of the land. And then in at least the reign of at least six different kings in Judah, Edom comes back and tries to defeat Israel. And sometimes they succeed and sometimes they fail. So there's this constant tug of war. Sometimes the Edomites control Seir, sometimes the Israelites control Seir. Back and forth, fighting, until, and this is where things come to a head, the Israelites are finally defeated by Babylon, carried off into exile. What do the Edomites do? They taunt them. They laugh at them. And then they sack Jerusalem and take what's left from what the Babylonians have not taken with them. I want to look at Psalm 137. This is a familiar psalm for its gruesomeness. It's sung by the waters of Babylon. They're weeping as they remember Zion. They're singing the songs of Zion, even though they can't be in Zion. Verse 4, they ask the question, how shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? And then they remember Jerusalem. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill, let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. And then this, remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, how they said, lay it bare, down to its foundations. Isn't it interesting they go after the Edomites before they go after the Babylonians? Because these are their brothers. And they taunt them as they're carried off into exile. And of course, the prophets are filled then with the same kind of talk, where the Edomites are told and the Israelites are told by God that Edom will be destroyed because they taunted Israel. Because in taunting Israel, they taunted God. And there's one whole book in the Minor Prophets, Obadiah, that's written about the destruction of Edom and the restoration of Israel. That's the history that we should have in our minds here. The seed of the serpent fighting against the seed of the woman. The serpent's trying to crush the woman's seed. And the woman is trying to crush the serpent's head. And the promise of God throughout the Old Testament is that one day, the people of God will have a seed that comes from the woman that will crush the head of the serpent. And that included in that will be the wicked people of Edom who hate Israel. And so this separation is just the beginning of the hostility that will ensue for the rest of the Old Testament all the way up till 70 AD. That's what we should have in our minds in verses 1 through 8 as they're separating, is the animosity that maybe it doesn't exist so much with Jacob and Esau anymore as a person, but certainly They pass it on to their sons and their daughters, and it continues for 8 centuries. But what's interesting then to note is that the rest of this genealogy talks about how great the nation of Edom becomes. Is that surprising? God's promise the destruction of the seed of the serpent and the ascendancy of the seed of the woman. And yet what we see in this chapter is that Edom becomes a great nation. Now there's some interesting things without getting into too many of the details. But in verses 9 through 14, there's actually 12 tribes of Edom. Just like there were 12 tribes of Ishmael. Again, showing the contrast and the competition between between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And so Esau has 3 wives, the grandchildren of the oldest son of his first wife has 5 sons who become heads of tribes. The next wife has a son who has 4 sons who become the heads of tribes. There's 9. And then his third wife has 3 sons, this time not grandsons, but sons who become tribes. So there's 12 tribes. And in the middle of that, you find this reference to Amalek. Verse 12. Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son. She bore Amalek to Eliphaz. Now, this isn't one of the 12 tribes. He doesn't get a tribe because he's the son through a concubine, not through a legitimate wife. And so Amalek is separated. And it's interesting that in the history of Israel, Amalek is separated from Edom. For instance, in Deuteronomy 23, verses 7 and 8, this is about Edom. God tells the Israelites that they must treat the Edomites as brothers. They're not allowed to destroy them. Even as they're going into the land of Canaan and they're supposed to destroy all the pagan nations, they're not supposed to touch Edom. But that's not true for Amalek. Turn quickly to Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16. This is, again, while they're wandering in the wilderness on their way to the promised land, that Amalek, this separate clan that comes out of Edom, that they attacked, secretly attacked Moses and the Israelites. And Moses leads them into battle. This is the one where Moses is holding up his hands, and as long as his hands are up in intercession, Israel's winning. And every time his hands drop, Israel starts losing. And so Aaron and another servant have to hold his hands up, and eventually the Israelites destroy Amalek. But notice how this chapter ends. The Lord said to Moses, verse 14, "Write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." Completely abolish them from the face of the earth. That's what God promises to do with Amalek now. Now, he promises that about Edom later, after the exile to Babylon. But up to this point, Edom's protected, but Amalek is set apart for destruction. And that's where we come to 1 Samuel 15 that we read this morning. Saul is sent to destroy Amalek. This is one of the nations that they're supposed to abolish from the land of Canaan. And Saul goes in and he destroys some of it, but he takes all the good stuff and he keeps the king. And it seems like he keeps some of the pretty women and, you know, the kind of things that you would want. And he destroys all the things that they wouldn't have wanted anyway, that would have just been hard to take with them. And to him, he can say that that's obedience somehow. And it's because of that, we're told, that's the final straw with Saul. That's the point where God says, "You're no longer my anointed and you will no longer be the king of the people of God." It's this point with the Amalekites when he doesn't fulfill what God promised to do in Exodus 17 and he disobeys a direct command of God. Now, what's interesting is that after that, David, at the end of 1 Samuel, in 1 Samuel 30, he's attacked by Amalekites and he decimates them. He destroys them. It's one of the ways that we know that David is a man after God's own heart and Saul is not, because he destroys every last bit of those Amalekites that chase after him. But Do you know when the Amalekites are completely destroyed? This is a really good Bible trivia question. Who is the one who finally brings about the destruction of the Amalekites in total? We never hear from them again. Yes, Mordecai. Haman is an Agagite, which is an Amalekite. King Agag is the one that Saul captures and that Samuel destroys. Haman is an Amalekite. And it's part of the reason that Mordecai won't bow to Haman. It's not because he won't bow to kings. People bow to kings in the Old Testament, and that's okay. They're not bowing to them as gods. One of the reasons he won't bow to Haman is because the older is supposed to bow to the younger, not the younger to the older. And the other reason that Mordecai is the perfect fit for destroying the Amalekites is because he's of the tribe of Benjamin. Who else is of the tribe of Benjamin? Saul. He does what Saul refused to do. And it's through Mordecai that the Amalekites are decimated. And we never hear from them again. Now there's another name that's important here in the genealogy that you might miss. Verse 11, it talks about Kenaz. By the way, one of the reasons I didn't read the genealogy is I can't do all those names. Kenaz. Kenaz is the father of the Kenazites, which is one of the 12 tribes of Esau. They're the one tribe that doesn't taunt the Israelites, and in fact joins the Israelites and fights with them against their enemies. And so they're always singled out in the rest of the Old Testament as the one part of Edom that's protected. They fight with Saul against the Amalekites. Now, there's one famous Kenazite in the Old Testament. We got a lot of Bible trivia tonight. It's important, though, to understand this genealogy. Do you know who's one of the famous great heroes of the Old Testament who's a Kenazite? This is probably the hardest one yet. Caleb is a Kenazite. One of two who remains faithful. One of two spies who's willing to obey God and go into Canaan is a descendant of Esau. How about that for a turn of events? And how about that for a fulfillment of the promise of the covenant that the people of God will be a blessing to the nations, even Edom? Even children of Esau will be part of the promise of the covenant, so that Caleb actually has a special place given to him in the land because of his faithfulness. And this is a child of Edom. Even the rejected son Esau has a place among God's people, at least for those who believe. Now we have to rush forward here, but I wanted to mention just what happens basically in verses 9 through 43, and I can do it in about 30 seconds. You see Esau getting really strong. Verses 9 through 14, he has tribes. Verses 15 through 19, all of a sudden he has chiefs. Verses 20 through 30, he has clans. And verses 31 through 43, he has kings. He becomes a great nation. And one of the most significant verses in this whole chapter is verse 31. These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. Now, do you understand how significant that would be? And then he goes on to list 8 kings that reigned in Edom before there were any kings in Israel. While Israel is in slavery and bondage, Edom is growing and becoming a powerful nation. While Israel is wandering in the wilderness, living on quail and manna and water, Edom is becoming a great nation. While Israel is ruled by judges, Edom is ruled by kings. It leaves us with a question, doesn't it? And I think this is the significance of this chapter for the Israelites as they're wandering in the wilderness. Can you imagine their questions? I thought we were the promised seed. Why is Edom prospering? Moses is teaching them about the sovereignty of God and about seeing with eyes of faith. They were sojourners in a land while Esau became rich and powerful. They were slaves in Egypt while Esau became rich and powerful. They were wandering in the wilderness while Esau became rich and powerful. And yet, they could have full confidence in the promise of God that the seed of the woman one day would crush the seed of the serpent. And I think that's where we're left in verse 37, verse 1, or chapter 37, verse 1. Edom became a great nation. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings as a pilgrim, without property, without a place. But the promise still remains. The older will bow to the younger. And the promise still remains that the Amalekites will be destroyed from the face of the earth, and eventually the Edomites, because of their wicked taunting of the Israelites, will be annihilated from the face of the earth. But look at Obadiah as we try to bring this all together. Anybody know where Obadiah is? After Amos, before Jonah. It's easy to miss. It's only two pages in there, so you can't just flip through and hope you see it. After Amos, before Jonah, is Obadiah. As I mentioned, this is the prophet who wrote only about Esau. He's promising the Israelites that despite their captivity in Babylon and the taunting of the Edomites, that eventually Israel would stand and Edom would fall. He describes the taunting in verses 10 through 14. I'm not going to read through that, but Edom's violence and taunting against Jacob. But then there's a promise that comes in three different places. First of all, verse 15. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations, that includes Edom and Babylon. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head. That's to Edom. Then verse 18. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble. They shall burn them and consume them, and there shall be no survivor for the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. That's promise number two. So we've already heard Esau will be destroyed. They'll get their comeuppance. Now we see that their destruction will come through Jacob and Joseph. And then finally, verse 21. This is important because there's a mountain in Esau and there's a mountain in Zion that face each other. The mountain in Esau is higher than the one in Zion, and they would brag about it. That's elsewhere in this prophet. But what it says in verse 21, saviors shall go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. So there's the promise. Esau will be destroyed. Jacob and Joseph will be the ones destroying, and the kingdom of both will belong to the Lord's. When do we see this promise fulfilled? What do you think? Where is this pointing us? Christ. What happens in Matthew 2? Jesus is born. The wise men come to King Herod, and they tell King Herod that this baby has been born, and he's the king of the Jews. And Herod freaks out. Why do you think Herod freaks out? Is Herod a Jew? What is he? He's an Edomite. He's an Edomian, which is a Hellenistic word for an Edomite. He doesn't want the king of the Jews, because that's a descendant of Jacob. They suppressed Jacob. They don't want to bow before Jacob. They don't want a king of the Jews. And so he sets out to kill him. There's the seed of the serpent, bruising the heel, the seed of the woman. But he can't destroy him, can he? And through Jesus, that fire and that flame that comes from Jacob and Joseph descends upon the Edomites. And they burn and they're consumed. And they turn to stubble. And by 70 AD, we never hear the Edomites again in the history of the world. They're gone. That's what I think we need to gather from this genealogy, is that the promise of God, it might take longer than we expect it to. Because we're sojourners, right? We're not that different than Jacob. We wander in a land that's foreign. And sometimes it feels like it's becoming more foreign every day, right? Nobody seeks after God. The fool says there's no God. We're surrounded by it. And we feel like foreigners in a strange land. But God promises that in the end, all those who stand opposed to God and to his people will be turned to stubble. And all those who stand with Christ will reign from Mount Zion. And what he calls us to do is live like Jacob with eyes of faith. I wanted to close with this quote from Matthew Henry. He said, "While the Israelites dwelt in the house of bondage and their Canaan was only the land of promise, the Edomites dwelt in their own habitations and Seir was in their possession. The children of this world have their all in hand now and nothing in hope, while the children of God have their all in hope and next to nothing in hand. But all things considered, it's better to have Canaan in promise than Mount Seir in possession." That's what it means to live with eyes of faith. To be able to look at all the things around us that are discouraging and frustrating. And to see the wicked prosper as we read about in the Psalms over and over again. And to know that my hope is always with God. And that whether I prosper in this life or not, that like Jacob, I sojourn and I wait with eyes of faith for a city that's better, whose builder and maker is God.